We'll begin our story of the crucifixion on John chapter 19, verse 15. But they cried out, "Away with him! Away with him! Crucify him!" I really appreciate the fact that we have studied this in pieces, because there's been an awful lot that's happened in this 24-hour period, roughly, and we've been able to look at it in sections. We've had the Last Supper. We've had the revealing of Judas Iscariot, and he has gone and done his thing. We've had the betrayal of Jesus in the garden. We've had this trial of Jesus, first before Annas, then before Caiaphas, then before Pilate, and then to Herod, and then back to Pilate. There's been a whole bunch of things that have gone on in this time period, and now we're to the point, Pontius Pilate has washed his hands, as it were. He's washed his hands of it. He's given up. He's exhausted every opportunity he had. He even tried the Barabbas card. Maybe we can get that to work. Nothing has worked. The Jews are intent upon having Jesus crucified. And so they call for him, away with him, crucify. Now the Romans were known for crucifixions. It wasn't a distinctly Roman idea, though. I think some of the Persians had even begun, and some of these foreign groups had taken the idea of crucifixion, but the Romans, they had made a system out of it. And so this was seen as a very highly Roman death. It was a very terrible and horrible way to die, a very painful way. And so now it's time for Jesus to be delivered to the cross. John 19 and 19. Now Pilate wrote a title and put it on the cross. And the writing was, "Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews." So just like today, we would have to establish a person. We'd have to call out what their crime is, what they've been sentenced for in a court of law. Very similar to this. On the cross, you would have an inscription that would say the name and tell what the crime was. So when people would see it, they would know what this person had been found guilty of. But the Jews didn't even like that. They couldn't even handle this idea of the sign saying, "Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews." They complained. Verse 20 says, "But many of the Jews read this title, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city, and it was written in Hebrew, Greek, and Latin. And therefore the chief priest of the Jews said to Pilate, 'Do not write, the King of the Jews, but he said, I am the King of the Jews.'" So even they wanted to fight about the semantics of the writing. And finally, Pilate has had enough. He has dealt enough with these Jews, and he says, "What I have written, I have written." Now, I found a picture of this. I think it's kind of neat. Someone had made an inscription of something, probably what it looked like, written in Hebrew, Greek, and Latin. And so there'd be this board or this placard, and it would be hung there upon the cross at the top, where people who walked by could see the inscription, see who the condemned was, and what had happened, what had caused them to be executed. This is Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. Verse 16, "Then he delivered him to them to be crucified. Then they took Jesus and led him away. And he, bearing his cross, went out to a place called the place of a skull, which is called in Hebrew Golgotha, where they crucified him, and two others with him, one on either side, and Jesus in the center." Now, I can't imagine what this must have been like, to have Jesus have to be paraded through the city of Jerusalem. This is often referred to as the way of the cross, or you may have heard it called the stations of the cross. Many times around Easter, there'll be different religious groups that will host parades or processions that mimic these ideas of where Jesus was as he went through the city. So here's kind of a pretty good little map that I found. Most of what has occurred has been over here. This is where the temple was, so that's where the high priest would have been. That's where Annas was. That's where Caiaphas was. This fortress, Antonia, most people think that's probably where Herod was staying. I can't tell you that for a fact. And Pilate was somewhere in this area as well. That's where all the governmental type buildings were in the city of Jerusalem. And so Jesus had been arrested here at the Garden of Gethsemane. He'd been brought across this brook of Kidron, the Kidron Valley. And here's where the events of that night had happened. Most people think that Calvary, or Golgotha, was on the west side over here of Jerusalem. Not 100% sure. And there's some different sites that are touted as Calvary. But whatever the case is, he had to get there. And so Jesus had to be led through the streets of Jerusalem. By this time, it's early in the morning. It's probably daylight. It's 7, 8 o'clock. Because we know Jesus was crucified officially at 9 o'clock. So he was brought around and he was led through the streets. And you got to remember, Jesus is not well. Jesus has been beaten. He has been scourged. And the old Roman way of saying it, they called the scourging the half death. So if you've ever heard that expression that you're going to beat someone half to death, probably where it came from was this idea of the scourging before a crucifixion. So Jesus was beaten. He was whipped. He was injured. He was bleeding. And he was hurting. And so he has to now make this walk to Calvary. Now the Romans had one more little twist they liked to do. They had the accused have to carry their own cross. And so Jesus then begins to carry his cross. Now, I don't know exactly what that means. I've read some different things. Some people think it means it was just the crossbar that they would carry across their back. Not necessarily the whole cross. I don't know. I know we used to have a fellow in town, I don't know if he still does it, he would carry this huge old cross. It had wheels on the back of it, so he kind of cheated a little bit, but he would walk up and down the streets just as an image of someone having to carry their cross. Well, Jesus begins to carry his cross. He's walking down the cobblestone streets of Jerusalem until he can make his way outside the city. Again, I can't tell you this where Calvary is, but I do know that Calvary was outside the city walls. I don't know where, but it was definitely outside without of the city, because that's part of prophecy that he would be done outside without the city walls. Well, anyway, he starts carrying that cross, and he can't handle it. Physically, he cannot handle it. And so in Matthew tells us, chapter 27, verse 32, now when they came out, they found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name, and him they compelled to bear his cross. So they see this man, Simon. You have to think it. How do they know his name? How does Matthew know that his name is Simon? How does he know from Cyrene? If you're just walking in the midst of a crowd and they, hey, you, come here, help him get that. How did they know his name? Well, there's only two logical options. Either they knew who he was beforehand, or they knew who he was afterward. By the time that it was written, they knew that this was Simon the Cyrene. I think I know the answer. Cyrene is actually in Libya. So he came from way down here. Jerusalem is way back on this side. It's in this area right here. So here was a strong Jewish population in Cyrene, which is what we would call Libya. You know, I don't know. There's been question as to what nationality Simon was. I don't know. All I know is he is from Cyrene, and he is there in the city of Jerusalem for the Passover. Well, all of a sudden now he has been compelled. And I don't know if compelled is like being voluntold. I don't know if you ever heard that word. Sometimes you are voluntold to do something. I don't know if that's the same way that what compelled means. Hey, you get over here and help him carry his cross. I don't know. But whatever the case, the whole idea that old Simon had left Cyrene and somehow made it over here to Jerusalem was to go to the Passover. Well, now he would be ceremonially unclean. Because now he has dealt with a condemned man. But whatever the case, Simon helps him carry his cross. Now Simon becomes a very important figure, really, in the church. He has a couple sons, we're told. One's named Rufus, and one is named Alexander. And sure enough, in Romans 16 and 13, some years later, Paul is writing, and he says, "Greet Rufus, chosen in the Lord, and his mother and mine." And most people agree that this is probably the same Rufus. This is probably the son of Simon the Cyrenian. This would be Simon's wife, who apparently had now met Paul's mother. And so I'm guessing Simon of Cyrene became a very strong member of the early church. Well, anyway, now Simon is helping him carry his cross. They've made their way through the city, and Jesus has a little bit of teaching left to do. In Luke 23, verse 27, it says, "And a great multitude of people followed him, and women who also mourned and lamented him." But Jesus, turning to them, said, Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For indeed the days are coming in which they will say, Blessed are the barren, wombs that never bore and breasts which never nursed. Then they will begin to say to the mountains, Fall on us, and to the hills, cover us. For if they do these things in the green wood, what will be done in the dry? So Jesus is going to teach a little bit more to these women. He says, there's coming a time that you don't need to be weeping for me. You need to be weeping for yourselves and for your children, because something terrible is going to happen. And so I can't help but think that Jesus is referring to the fall of Jerusalem, which would be about 40 years later. It's going to be so terrible. All that city, Jerusalem, that he loved, that city of God, he says, it's going to be terrible. It's going to be like anything you've ever seen. Blessed are the barren. You're going to wish you didn't have children when something like this happens. But I love the way that Jesus is teaching even until the very end. I saw a movie many years ago. It's called The Green Mile. And so The Green Mile was in reference to the green stripe that was on the floor that the executed condemned man had to walk from his jail cell to the electric chair. They called that The Green Mile. Jesus is on his green mile, if you will. He is walking his final steps from the trial through the streets of Jerusalem to where he's going to be executed. But even so, Jesus doesn't quit teaching. And he still starts pulling in all of these ideas, fall on us and cover us. I noted those because now he's pulling back in Old Testament prophecy. That's from Hosea. Hosea 10 and 8. And also the high priest of Avon, which means idolatry or wickedness. He said, The sin of Israel shall be destroyed. The thorn and the thistle shall grow on their altars. They shall say to the mountains, Cover us. And to the hills, Fall on us. So Jesus using the same exact imagery that Hosea had used hundreds of years before. And guess what? John uses the same thing in Revelation chapter 6, verses 15 and 16. Verse 16, he said to the mountains and the rocks, Fall on us and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lord. Don't you love the way Jesus is able to tie things together from the prophets to Jesus all the way to the book of Revelation as he is walking to his execution? Jesus never gave up. Jesus never lost control of the situation. Matthew chapter 27, verse 33 tells us, When they had come to a place called Golgotha, that is to say the place of a skull, they gave him sour wine mingled with gall to drink. But when he had tasted it, he would not drink. So this idea of gall mixed with sour wine, Mark says it was myrrh. So that's myrrh. You can still buy myrrh today. It's one of those essential oils. They can either, sometimes they would crumble it up. Other times you can extract the oil from the leaves. And they say it was still used for a lot of medicinal type purposes. Now, I was reading on something. They said you can't use myrrh with COVID. So apparently people have tried that. The CDC says you can't treat COVID with myrrh. But people still use this for different things, especially back in, you know, in third world type countries. But they said this idea of the myrrh was if you mixed it with the vinegar, it was an analgesic, or it was a pain reliever. And so mixing this vinegar with the myrrh was at least the Romans' semi-sense of humanity. They would at least let the condemned man dull the pain a little bit. So Jesus tasted it, realized what it was, and then he would not drink it. He was in control. He didn't want his mind altered at all. Jesus is in control until the very, very end. Verse 35, and then they crucified him. I can't imagine what the crucifixion must have been like. What a horrible, horrible way to die. You know, I've heard several sermons that really go into great detail. That's not my purpose here this morning. I'm going to tell you that Jesus died a horrible and terrible death. And he was nailed to a cross. Now, I will show you this. I found some pictures of some old nails, some crucifixion type nails that have been found. If you notice this one right here, that'll put it into perspective for you. That's a bone. That's a human bone that nail is going through. So this is it was horrible. It's a horrible, terrible way to die. And Jesus has now been crucified and put upon the cross there at Calvary. He's in pain. He's hurting. yet he refused pain medicine. That's something right there. I go to the dentist, and I can't wait to get that Novocaine. And here's Jesus being crucified, having nails driven through his hands, through his feet, is given the opportunity for some relief, and he refuses to accept it because he wants his mind to be free. Back to John. It says, then the soldiers, when they had crucified Jesus, took his garments and made four parts, to each soldier a part, and also the tunic. Now the tunic was without seam, woven from the top in one piece. And there they said therefore among themselves, let us not tear it, but cast lots for it. Whose it shall be, that the scriptures might be fulfilled, which says, they divided my garments among them, and my clothing they cast lots. Therefore the soldiers did these things. Well, that comes from Psalm 22. Do you think that Roman soldier who said, hey, no, don't cut him, let's just cast lots for it, do you think he realized he was fulfilling prophecy from hundreds of years before? Probably not. But God understood the plan. And so Psalm 22 and 18 is exactly what David had written hundreds of years before. They said, they're not going to tear your clothes, but they'll cast lots for your clothes. But Jesus didn't own a lot. I don't know that Jesus owned much of anything, but he did own that tunic, about all that he had. But his clothes were not divided. It was not torn amongst the four, but instead they cast lots. Everybody has homework today. I want you to go home and read Psalm 22 in its entirety. Read Psalm 22 once we've talked about the crucifixion today and see how everything fits together. Psalm 22 is one of the prettiest chapters. It's tragic. One of the prettiest chapters in all the Bible. So these soldiers, typically there was four. I don't know if that's how many there were in this case, but there was typically four assigned to a condemned man. Matthew 27 and 36, sitting down, they kept watch over him there. And they put up over his head the accusation written against him, this is Jesus, the King of the Jews. And the two robbers were crucified with him, one on the right and another on the left. And so now these soldiers sit down and they're watching Jesus be crucified. And they put the sign up that we talked about earlier. Now the sign went on top of the head of Jesus on the cross. Now that I think about it, they probably had a couple other signs. One of them that said, a robber. You know, we had the two robbers on either side. I don't know what their names were, but I suppose they had an inscription placed above their heads as well, so everybody could know the cause of their execution. Luke tells us, then Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Now that's a very famous passage. We hear that a lot. Who's Jesus talking to? Who's Jesus talking about? You ever thought about that? Well, it's in reference to those Roman soldiers. That's who he's talking about, the Roman soldiers who were tasked with watching over his death. That's who Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Matthew 27, verse 39, says, and those that passed by blasphemed him, wagging their heads and saying, you who destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross. So where did these people get all those words from? Where did they get those insults from? They're just making fun of Jesus, right? That's the things Jesus had been talking about in the previous week. He had talked about how he's going to destroy the temple. I'm going to build it again within 3 days. See, Jesus had been teaching and people had been listening. But now they've taken his words and they've twisted. Verse 41, likewise the chief priest also, mocking with the scribes and elders, said, he saved others, himself he cannot save. If he is the King of Israel, let him now come down from the cross and we will believe him. He trusted in God. Let him deliver him now if he will have him. For he said, I am the Son of God. And so now you got the chief priests. We've got those that are passing by. We're going to talk about that in just a second. And everybody is now turning against Jesus. Verse 44, even the robbers who were crucified with him reviled him with the same thing. Oh, I thought you were the King of the Jews. Well, if you're the Son of God, why don't you come down from that cross? If you're so powerful, why don't you come down? Why don't you bring us with you? And just these constant jabs and constant insults, blaspheming the Son of God. Now, I want to talk about this for just a second, because I've got something I think wrong in my head that I had to have fixed. See, I have it underlined here, those that pass by. There's people walking by. They're outside the walls of Jerusalem. Remember, it's the Passover. And people are walking into the city of Jerusalem. And they had to be in by noon. So from about 9 to noon, it was probably pretty busy on that road as they were walking into the city of Jerusalem. Now, for some reason, I have it in my head that the cross was super, super tall. I've always had that in my mind, that Jesus and the two robbers there are pretty good ways up there. And you're looking up at the cross. But you know what? I really don't think that's the case anymore. So I'm going to jump ahead in the story just a little bit. Towards the end, Jesus is given some wine or some vinegar to drink. John 19 and 29 says, and they filled a sponge with sour wine and put it on hyssop. Another account says they put it on a reed. It's a hyssop reed. There's a picture of hyssop. It's a plant that grows about, I don't know, yay high. And so that sponge was put on a stalk or on a reed of hyssop and had to be able to reach Jesus' mouth. Jesus wasn't 20 foot in the air. Jesus wasn't 15 foot in the air. Jesus was pretty close to the ground. Because he had to be able to reach. I want you to think about this a little bit. Scholars really believe that the cross was probably about 8 to 10 foot tall. That's it. There weren't any trees up there in that area either, so I don't know where they got a 10-foot tree anyway. I had to bring it probably from somewhere else. I'm going to go back to my fence building days of my youth. We always tried to get everything about 2 foot in the ground before you put a pipe in. I don't know how deep the hole they put, but let's say you have a 10-foot cross and you dig a 2-foot hole and you put that tree inside or you put that cross inside that hole, that leaves about 8 foot. You had to have something on top, enough room, clearance to put that placard that says, this is Jesus, King of the Jews. And you had to keep him off of the ground. But I'm telling you, I got thinking about it. I want you to imagine this. Imagine where my eyes are. I bet the people weren't a foot down from where Jesus' eyes were. And so I've always had it in my mind that Jesus was way up there on the cross. I don't think that's the case. I bet they were almost, you touch his face and see him. It was that close. 8 to 10 foot cross would not be very much. So keep that in mind as we go through the story, because there's a couple instances here we're going to talk about that I think that really plays into it. Now that being said, I don't think those Roman soldiers would let people get too close to Jesus. I don't think they would let a crowd get too close to the condemned man. But what I'm saying is, this was a very personal death. They could see Jesus. He's right there. They could hear the words that he was saying. They could see the blood and the sweat dripping from him. It was a very personal, personal death. Luke 23:36. The soldiers also mocked him, coming and offer him sour wine and saying, if you are the King of the Jews, save yourself. You expect that out of some Roman soldiers, right? The exact same Roman soldiers that Jesus just prayed for and said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. They didn't take much advantage of it. But these criminals, man, they should have known better. Luke 23 and 39 tells us, then one of the criminals who was hanged blasphemed him, saying, if you are the Christ, save yourself and us. But the other answered and rebuked him, saying, do you not even fear God, seeing you're under the same condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we receive the due reward of our deeds. But this man has done nothing wrong. Then he said to Jesus, Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And Jesus said to him, assuredly I say to you, today you'll be with me in paradise. And so there is a sermon we often heard, the thief on the cross. And so he says, listen, we deserve what we're getting. How are you talking bad to Jesus? He's innocent. He's done nothing wrong. We have deserved every bit of this. You got to figure they were involved in some of the same shenanigans that Jesus was. With Pilate and Annas and Caiaphas. You got to figure they were all kind of together, probably chained together, walking around, I would assume. They heard everything. They probably heard Pilate said, listen, I find no fault in this man. They had fault. They deserved what they were getting. And this one thief on the cross says, man, we can't talk about that to Jesus. Now, something interesting here. But I told you to look at John. In John's account, look at verse 24. John 19 and verse 24, they're still dividing up the tunic, right? Talks about the soldiers dividing the garments among them, fulfilling the prophecy. And then we get to verse 25, and now we're towards the end of the crucifixion. So something interesting happened. John's an eyewitness. He's there. In fact, many people believe out of the four accounts, John's the only one that was a true eyewitness to the crucifixion. Yet here, John doesn't mention any of these comments. He doesn't mention the thief on the cross. He doesn't mention the people walking by the cross making fun of him. He doesn't mention the chief priest. There's none of that. And so I wonder why. In fact, there kind of appears to be a gap in his chronological order between verse 24 and verse 25. It appears that John leaves the crucifixion because he starts it, and that's at 9 o'clock in the morning, and then he doesn't talk about any of the people walking by or passing by. That ended at noon, and then it appears that John returns. So where in the world did John go? What did he do? Why doesn't he record any of this? Well, here's my thought right there. I think John had a more important task to do. Because when John resurfaces at the crucifixion, he's no longer alone. In fact, he's with a whole group of people. John 19 and 25 tells us, "Now there stood by the cross of Jesus his mother and his mother's sister, Mary the wife of Clopas and Mary Magdalene." Somebody had to go get Mary. Somebody had to go get his aunt. Somebody had to go get these different people. I think that's where John was. I think John was probably the one that was corralling all these women together, taking them to the crucifixion. Verse 26, "When Jesus therefore saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing by," that's John, "he said to his mother, 'Woman, behold your son.' And then he said to the disciple, 'Behold your mother.' And from that hour, that disciple took her to his own home." So now John has been given the responsibility of taking care physically of the mother of Jesus. Mark 15, "Now when the sixth hour had come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour." Well, the way Mark is reckoning time here, this would have been noon to 3 o'clock. And about the ninth hour, Matthew chapter 27, verse 46 tells us, "Jesus cried out with a loud voice." And he says something here in Aramaic, and I can't pronounce any of it. All I know is I see this first part, "Eli, Eli." And so, remember, they're really close to Jesus. They hear him say this. So they hear these words, and they're not sure what he's saying. It translates, my God, why have you forsaken me?" That's from Psalm 22. That's why that's your homework. Read Psalm 22. Verse 47 says, "Some of those who stood by when they heard that said, 'This man is calling for Elijah.'" So they heard these, sounded like Elijah. "And immediately one of them ran and took a sponge, filled it with sour wine, and put it on a reed," a hyssop reed, "and offered it to him to drink. And the rest said, 'Let him alone. Let us see if Elijah will come to save him.'" John tells us, "And after this, Jesus, knowing that all things were now accomplished, that the scriptures might be fulfilled, said, 'I thirst.' Now a vessel full of sour wine was sitting there, and they filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on hyssop, and put it to his mouth." Remember, they're only having to reach up a couple feet to see, to reach the mouth of Jesus. "And when Jesus had cried out with a loud voice, he said, 'Father, into your hands I commit my spirit.' And having said this, he breathed his last." And there Jesus died upon the cross. Now, there's one more thing that the Romans liked to do. They wanted to speed things up. There was times, like on this particular day, it was called the Jewish Day of Preparation. They had to get these people off of the cross. They couldn't have these dead bodies hanging on a cross. They had to speed things up. So one thing that they would do is they would come and break the legs, which would hasten the suffocation. It would speed up the crucifixion. So I want you to think about this now. John 19, 32, "Then the soldiers came and broke the legs of the first and of the other who was crucified with him. But when they came to Jesus and saw that he was already dead, they did not break his legs. But one of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear, and immediately blood and water came out." Now, I found this neat little picture. I want to show it to you. When the Romans would break these legs, they had like an iron hammer, like a sledgehammer. But I want you to look at that picture, because I think that's probably the proper height. So when this Roman soldier was swinging it, Jesus is just about 2 foot above him. And so when he's swinging, he would have hit that leg right there to break that bone. But that didn't happen with Jesus. So I think this image of Jesus being, you know, 20, 25 feet up in the air, I don't think that's correct. I think it would have been a much more personal experience with Jesus just being a little bit above eyesight. So the two thieves, they had their legs broken. But when they got to Jesus, he was already dead, and the bones were not broken. That's part of prophecy as well. Psalm 34 and 20, he guards all his bones. Not a one of them is broken. Probably goes back to Exodus, because this is talking about the Passover, Jesus being the Passover lamb as well. The Passover lamb, it says, shall be eaten in one house. You shall not carry any of its flesh outside the house, nor shall you break one of its bones. So I would assume there's some carryover from the Passover to Jesus. Zechariah says, and I will pour out on the house of David, on the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the spirit of grace and supplication. Then they will look on me whom they pierced. Yes, they will mourn for him as one mourns for his only son, and grieve for him as one who grieves for a firstborn. So Jesus was pierced. He was pierced on the side, and now it makes more sense how the Roman soldier was able to reach him. It was just with the spear. And he stabbed him into the side and said, and out came forth blood. Matthew tells us now, when the centurion and those who were with him were guarding Jesus, saw the earthquake and the things that had happened, they feared greatly, saying, truly this was the Son of God. So it took them a while, but even the Romans realized it. So these things that happened, the Bible tells us one was this, the temple veil was torn. Now that was pretty impressive in and of itself. Huge old 60-foot veil was ripped. So there was an earthquake. Most impressive to me, it said those resurrection dead there in the grave that were up walking around Jerusalem. I think I would have said, truly this was the Son of God as well. I have two passages left to leave you with as we close our lesson. You know, the crucifixion was a very brutal and horrible scene. But in doing so, it's very fortunate for us. It's very fortunate for the world that now because of that, we have an opportunity for something. We have a hope of something that did not exist before. So let me leave you first with 1 Peter 2. 1 Peter 2, verse 21. For to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow his steps. Who committed no sin, nor was deceit found in his mouth. Who when he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously. Who himself bore our sins in his own body on the tree, that we, having died to sins, might live for righteousness, by whose stripes you were healed. He bore our sins on the cross. If you're not a Christian, if you've never taken those steps of salvation, we can't save you. We need to accept the gospel, and we need to understand how important that statement is. He bore our sins in his own body on the tree. Because nobody else can do that. That's what the crucifixion provides. And finally, Colossians chapter 2, verse 13. And you being dead in your trespasses and the uncircumcision of your flesh, he has made alive together with him, having forgiven you all trespasses, having wiped out the handwriting of requirements that was against us, which was contrary to us, and he has taken it out of the way, having nailed it to the cross. That law of Moses, that unattainable law, has been nailed to the cross through the sacrifice of Jesus. What a wonderful, horrible, tragic, yet at the same time glorious day that Jesus died upon the cross on our behalf. Concludes the thoughts for this morning. We never like to close off without having a song of invitation.